This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. The belief that homosexuality is a sin and that you can be healed of this sin with the help of Jesus is the premise of Christian gay conversion therapy. The new film, The Miseducation of Cameron Post, is set in the early 90s at a fictional residential gay conversion therapy program called God's Promise, where teenagers are sent by their parents or guardians, usually against the will of the teenager. Once arriving at God's Promise, the teens are called disciples and are forced to conform to rigid rules. Their communication with the outside world is cut off for several months, and they have to agree that all sexual behavior outside of marriage between a man and a woman is a sin. I have two guests. Desiree Akhavan directed and co-wrote the new film. Emily Danforth wrote the young adult novel the film was adapted from. The novel, also called The Miseducation of Cameron Post, was first published in 2012. Let's start with a scene from the film. Cameron, the main character, played by Chloe Grace Moretz, has been sent to God's Promise after she was discovered making out with her girlfriend. In this scene, soon after she's arrived at God's Promise, she's been invited by Reverend Rick, played by John Gallagher Jr., to talk with him over a game of ping pong. Rick is one of the people who runs God's Promise. He considers himself ex-gay, having been, quote, cured of homosexuality with the help of his older sister, who founded and directs God's Promise.
So this worked for you then? Like you changed?
Yes. I changed.
How?
It was a process. It's funny, actually. The moment things began to turn around, I was in a bar.
Bar?
Yeah. A gay bar, of all places. Two men from my church came in. They saw my car parked outside, and they knew I'd been struggling, so they came in looking for me.
Wow.
It was God, Cameron. I asked for his help, and he gave it to me in the form of those allies. I was so deeply unhappy. But I didn't think I was worth saving. And I wonder if you've asked that of yourself. Are you worth saving?
Desiree Akhavan, Emily Danforth, welcome to Fresh Air. Emily, since you wrote the novel that the movie's based on, let me start with you. Why did you want to write about gay conversion centers in the early 90s?
First of all, thank you so much for talking to us both. Gay conversion therapy loomed large in the landscape of my life as a closeted teenager, growing up much like Cameron does in the novel, in rural ranch town eastern Montana of the 1990s. I didn't go to conversion therapy, but there was this sense of it as a threat that if I spoke up more, if I came out, I knew I was gay, I was closeted, that certainly my friends, really my peer group, would suggest this for me. I was not raised evangelical. I was raised Lutheran, but all of my friends, 8th grade, 9th grade, 10th grade years, were evangelicals. And I think I associated with them. I think I tried to speak that language and think that way, partly as an act of self-protection. I thought, if I hang out with these folks, maybe I won't say that I'm gay. They'll kind of keep me closeted, which will be a safer space to be.
You know, it's interesting to me that you perceive the threat of, like, turning you into a gay conversion therapy center. You perceive the threat as coming from your peers, your fellow eighth graders, not from the adults. And that culture, I think, encouraged snitching on people you suspected were gay. Did you feel like your friends were also potential snitches?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, I think it's so strange for me to look back, because even by junior, senior year, that was not my peer group. But I absolutely kind of went right into what was like the danger zone. I mean, I was like, let me carry a Bible around high school with me and let me meet with you in the mornings to pray before class, and adopt really this whole sort of lifestyle that was not, it wasn't in my house. It was my friends. With this sense that they're going to keep me from being true to myself, essentially, and that's safer.
Did you want Jesus to heal you from being gay when you were in middle school?
I don't think that I did. I wanted... I wanted to be accepted. I mean, I think like most middle school kids, I wanted to feel okay about myself. I don't think that I wanted Jesus to take this thing away. I mean, I don't think I ever really bought into it. I saw it more as a way to hide, right? I saw it more as an act of self-protection, but I don't think I ever really had the kind of faith that allowed me to believe in it. I mean, to believe that it was true.
I think the environment that you create at the Gay Conversion Center is what's sometimes called a total environment, where like everything in it is controlled, and the attempt is to control your mind too. And everything is for Jesus. Even the aerobics exercises that they watch are Jesus-centered aerobics. It's a blesser-size, not an exercise. And I just want to play the song that's sung in this blesser-size video.
Let's engage in some cardiovascular fitness unto the Lord. Ready?
It's gonna be fun to exercise with Jesus. To be fit for him in every way. He will bless my body, soul, and spirit, and keep me with him every day. I'm gonna sing praise, hallelujah, cause my body's growing firm and strong.
You know what we're doing here? We're developing our inner person. You are heading toward godliness, you see, in every area of your life, and that takes some work.
Okay, Emily, was there a blesser-size video you based this on or something similar?
There was. And in fact, I think that's something we talked about.
Well, I just want to make it clear that Emily had written this amazing Tandy Campbell character, this jazzercise for Jesus icon. And we were going to shoot a video, but then my co-writer and producer, Cecilia Frugiuele, found this video online, and we ended up finding the rights to that actual video. And it's one of my favorite things in the whole film, and I did not direct it. So I just want to make sure it's clear that that was not created by me.
But it's real.
I love it, too.
But it's real.
And that's kind of what I was saying, is I think when we had first talked about that, you thought that I had made that up. You gave me more
credit. Oh, yeah, I did. I was like, stop making fun of Christians.
But I did not make up blesser-size. I mean, that what you're saying, that total environment, I mean, I think that's a lot of what I was adopting. I went only to Christian rock concerts for those first couple of years. It was this kind of sense that everything secular is sinful and every aspect of our life has to somehow be, including aerobics, right? I mean, all of it has to be somehow in praise of the Lord.
You know, at the beginning of the movie, your main character is in a Bible study class, and the adult leading the class is saying, you know, as adults, we're trying to undo the things we did when we were your age. You're at an age when you're especially vulnerable to evil, and you won't see it now or tomorrow, but what feels like fun is actually the enemy, and that enemy is closing a noose around your neck. Did either of you hear adults telling you that?
I didn't hear adults telling me that, but when I was doing research for this, that was from a sermon I had heard. It was part of a much longer, very passionate, very violent speech.
What violent in what respect?
It was for kids. It was for teens. And the way this man was criminalizing instincts of children felt violent to me. And the whole film, while we were making it, like the last, no spoiler alerts here, but I think the last moment of the film, you get to feel like these kids are finally allowed to be children again. And you realize that the whole time they've had this criminal sexuality projected onto them, and that actually they were just kids messing around.
But, you know, this sermon isn't even just about homosexuality. It's about, like, all, like, pleasure. The things that give you pleasure, they're sins. So it's kind of like cutting off the possibility of pleasure because it's evil. And I think,
well,
yeah.
I'm sorry to cut you off, but as I was co-writing it, the adaptation, I realized that everything about this world reminded me so much of my time in a rehabilitation center. I had spent time in an outpatient rehabilitation center for an eating disorder in my 20s, and it really changed my life in a fantastic way. It was a great experience and a really painful, difficult one, and I was really familiar with being in group therapy and the dynamics of giving yourself up wholly, like, to not wholly H-O-L-Y, but W-H-O, to something larger than yourself and blindly trusting other people around you. And when you're ill, specifically with an eating disorder, you lose connection with your own instincts and mm-hmm. your own sense of hunger, your own sense of the right behavior and the wrong behavior. And you trust everyone around you. And there's something really, I wasn't raised religious, but the thing about religion that really attracts me is someone with all the answers. And there's such a comfort in that. It's interesting, when you have an eating disorder, you have a voice in your head that's speaking nonsense. And the longer you're in therapy or in group or rehab or whatever, you slowly develop this other voice that combats it. That's, you know, the therapy voice or the wanting to get better. You know, the other voice drowns out the crazy in you and you slowly start to function a little better each day. And what if the voice that was drowning out your instinct was a religious one? And it was trying to kill in you the instinct that was as inherently a part of you as your sexuality.
Yeah, well, the way you're describing it, it's taking, like, the gay conversion is taking a legitimate form of therapy and group therapy and using it to fight who you are, not to bring out who you are. And it's doing it for harm and not for your own good. So that's part of your doorway in, is having undergone a group therapy yourself, but feeling like it was a very positive thing, not a destructive thing. But, you know, in the gay conversion centers, what's really, like, unusual, inexplicable in a way, is that these conversion centers, the residential centers, they're trying to convert gay and lesbian kids from being gays and lesbians by surrounding them with other gays and lesbians and giving them, like, gay and lesbian roommates. And yep. It's like, yep. Maybe that's not the finest way of going about it.
I think there's something really beautiful in that. Your sexual instincts are being kind of beaten out of you with a twisted version of the Bible. But at the same time, you're connecting to people who are like you and you're no longer isolated. Because you imagine these people who end up in therapy centers aren't able to connect to openly queer kids around them.
Absolutely. And that's so much a part of the novel, again, when it was said, is that Cam doesn't know any other, certainly out, queer kids, right? I mean, she's desperately querying any sort of film that she can get her hands on from the local video store that might have some kind of, like, hint of sapphic attraction in it. I mean, and so the idea that she's, like, finally meeting queer kids, even though it's in this space where they're being told that what they are is a sin and they need to eradicate it, I think it's really powerful. I mean, I didn't know a single out person until I got to college. I mean, obviously there were queer people in my town, but I did not know anyone who was out.
I want to play another brief scene from the new movie, The Miseducation of Cameron Post. And in this scene, the main character, Cam, played by Chloe Grace Moretz, is being oriented to the gay conversion group God's Promise by the woman who runs the program, Dr. Lydia Marsh. And she's played by Jennifer Ely, and she speaks first.
Your struggle is with the sin of same-sex attraction. The first step is for you to stop thinking of yourself as a homosexual.
I don't think of myself as a homosexual. I mean, I don't really think of myself as anything.
You should think of yourself as a Christian.
What I like about that scene is that it's clear that the Cameron character is too young to have a firm sense of her identity, and what she has as an identity is being, like, drummed out of her. Do you want to talk about writing that line, Emily, about, like, I don't think of myself as anything?
Is that my line, Desi, or is that
I was going to say, this is kind of ingenious.
Okay, right.
Yeah, yes. I remember this
you
specifically,
wrote the screenplay,
actually.
Desiree, yeah. Good. Yeah, go ahead. Good.
I remember this so well because Emily had read a draft, and we wrote that scene. Like, that scene was mostly fabricated, but then I think it ended with, I don't think of myself as anything. And Emily wrote back, or we spoke on the phone about it, and she was like, no, Dr. Marsh would say you should think of yourself as a Christian. So
oh
that
God,
was a real collaboration between the two of us. If I remember correctly, that was...
I'm going to take it.
Emily yes-anding my co-writer and I and finishing that scene.
One thing I want to say about the character of Lydia Marsh is, at least in the novel, she was very informed by a woman named Dr. a doctor is questionable, Elizabeth Moberly, who gets a lot of dubious credit for her early theories. She coined the term reparative therapy. She was doing a lot of work in this area in the 1980s. She was essentially a self-professed psychoanalyst, and she came up with this theory of part of the reason that people are gay is that they haven't had effective homosocial bonding, homosocial love with their parent. And a lot of this traces back to Elizabeth Moberly. So when I was thinking of Lydia, I was thinking of this woman that loomed large in the 1980s and 1990s discussions of reparative or conversion therapy. That's who I was channeling.
What were the worst consequences you each learned about? Consequences for teenagers who were in these gay conversion residential centers?
Absolutely suicide. I mean, either in the facility itself or after, right, having undergone treatment and then gone home. Other kinds of self-harm, certainly. Living a life of denial. I mean, I got an email yesterday from a woman who said that her now 50-year-old brother was very involved in Exodus and the teachings of Exodus, which is referenced in the novel.
That's one of the gay conversion groups.
Yeah, it was an umbrella organization for all these gay conversion centers and preachers, which is since disbanded. But, you know, she said he went to the conferences and, you know, essentially he's 50 years old. This has been 30 years of this, and he's still is, you know, living a life of denial and shame. So that's a consequence as well.
Desiree, how did you go about casting the teenagers in this? Did you want to make sure that a certain number of the teenagers were really gay? Was that an issue at all? Because it seems to be an issue in casting now. I'm thinking of, like, Scarlett Johansson being pressured to, like, step down from her role as trans in a forthcoming film.
To me, that's completely different. I don't think it's appropriate as a director to ask teen actors what their sexuality is.
That's a really good point. Like, unless they're out, like, are you gay enough to?
Yeah, I know.
Yeah.
People always ask me, like, I got a lot of questions about this. And it's like, don't forget, these are all teenagers. Mm. It was a set of teens, and it's not my place to ask them who they prefer. And I think when people make assumptions about young actors, that's a bit toxic and gossipy. It's not my place. I care a lot that my HODs, my heads of department, are female. I care that my collaborators are queer. I want to create an environment where my work has authenticity. That matters to me, and that's within my control. But I think it's really strange to make assumptions about an actor's sexuality. In terms of gender, I think there's a lot to be said about casting trans actors in trans roles or seeing trans actors for cis roles. Mm-hmm. That's a debate I want to engage in. But I can't quite put my finger, you know, on a 19-year-old sexuality, and nor would I want to approach that.
Hmm. Emily, the novel, The Miseducation of Cameron Post, is dedicated to your parents. When you were coming out, were your parents supportive of you?
Oh, is this the part where I cry? My mother absolutely was. I wrote her a letter. It sounds so curiously old-fashioned, but I wrote her a letter from college. And then, of course, when you do that, if you come out that way, you just have to wait for the response.
Like,
I didn't know if she'd gotten the letter. I sent it to her at her office so my father wouldn't read it. And I'm just waiting and waiting. I didn't have a cell phone. And finally, the call comes in my dorm room. And she said, I think the very classic, of course, we love you, but I think life is going to be very hard for you. And I didn't tell my dad for several years after that. I mean, it was, you know, I just didn't think he would get it. So it was this weird kind of open secret where my mom knew and my sister knew. My dad, though, by the time, you know, my wife and I had been together for a number of years, he did come to my wedding, and I think tried to come around and understand in his way.
What's interesting is that, like, this film is about gay conversion therapy, and it's specifically about the topic of coming out. And I'm queer, and I had to come out. My family, both my parents are immigrants from Iran. My brother was born there. They moved to New York City right before I was born. And coming out was hands down the hardest thing I've ever had to do. But I don't think that this is a film that only speaks to that experience. I didn't grow up religious. I didn't want to make a film that mocked religion and put down evangelical Christians. What I wanted to talk about was fear about going against what was right. And that's what I felt growing up, that there's a very prescribed rule book for behavior, for women, how to be beautiful, how to be feminine, how to be appropriate, for men, how to be masculine, for sex, how to do it, how to not talk about it, how to, you know, all these different things in life that you're coded. And, you know, I learned a lot of those lessons from film and television, and then for how to be an American, and then from my family and our insular Iranian community in the tri-state area.
Desiree Akhavan directed and co-wrote the new movie, The Miseducation of Cameron Post. Emily Danforth wrote the novel the film is adapted from. A little later in the show, Michael Arsenault will talk about growing up Black, gay, and Catholic, the subject of his new memoir. But first, our rock critic Ken Tucker has a review of the new album by country music songwriter Laurie McKenna. She's co-written big hits for Carrie Underwood, Tim McGraw, and Little Big Town. Last year, she became the first woman to win Songwriter of the Year at the Academy of Country Music Awards. Less well-known is the music Laurie McKenna records herself. She's released 10 albums since 2000, and the new one is called The Tree. Here's Ken's review.
Here's what I know. Even when she's sleeping, she's still dreaming about you. That's the way that it goes.
That's A Mother Never Rests, and it's the way Laurie McKenna kicks off her new album, The Tree. In its quiet way, that song, about the work and rewards of motherhood, is an assertion of strong principles. McKenna prizes parenthood and domestic chores as worthy, rewarding labor. Take a line like, "She's a stubborn believer that time and a clean house is how you heal." That is as far from any sentiment you'll hear in current pop music as is possible to imagine in 2018, and all the more valuable for it. So is McKenna's emphasis on the positive and the optimistic in the song, Happy People. Toward the end of that song, McKenna sings, "Life is short and love is rare, and we all deserve to be happy while we're here." Her golden rule approach to life sounds inspirational in an unassuming way. McKenna's 2007 album was called Unglamorous, which suits both McKenna's performing persona and her vocal style, which is assiduously unshowy and conversationally straightforward. Working in an industry that idealizes youth, she likes to talk about grown-ups and their concerns. Her song, People Get Old, has a James Taylor, Sweet Baby James vibe to its melody.
Someone said youth is wasted on the young. Spilled every last drop of time that summer in the sun. The daddy had a Timex watch, cigarette in his hand and a mouthful of scotch. Spinning me around like a tilted world on his arm. Houses need paint, winters bring snow. Kids, come on in before your supper gets cold. Collection plates and daddy's billfold, and that's how it goes. You live long enough, people get old.
A Massachusetts native who struck gold in country further south, McKenna found success doing co-writes in the language of contemporary Nashville. Her collaborations, frequently with Hillary Lindsay and Liz Rose, are characterized by intricate emotional setups and clever verbal executions. McKenna, Lindsay, and Rose, who refer to themselves as the Love Junkies, had perhaps their biggest hit with Girl Crush, as recorded by Little Big Town. It's a song sung by a woman who describes her obsession with the woman who's currently with the man she loves. That kind of twist is something McKenna is fond of, and you can hear that sensibility at work here on a song such as You Can't Break a Woman, with its chorus about the strength a woman can have in withholding her love.
Whiskey breath don't faze her anymore. Well, she don't mind sleeping alone. She got over all of that a long, long time ago. Whiskey breath don't faze her anymore. She got wiser every time you lied, sobered up every time you got drunk. Every time you were stoned, she just got a little more numb. She pulled a little bit further away every time you walked out the door.
Tree is produced by Dave Cobb, who has overseen big, booming hits for Sturgill Simpson and Chris Stapleton. But Cobb proves his range here by showcasing McKenna's plain-spoken modesty with similarly modest, subtle production. At another time in pop music, Laurie McKenna would have been classified a folk singer. But in the current industry, the only place her intimate, acoustic-based music fits is in country music. Even so, her songs stand out. Tim McGraw had a hit with her tune Humble and Kind, even as many listeners thought, Humble and Kind? Now there's a couple words you don't hear very often. If you want a whole collection of the kind of thing you don't hear very often these days, The Tree may be your kind of album.
Ken Tucker is critic at large for Yahoo TV. He reviewed The Tree, the new album from country music songwriter Laurie McKenna.
The tree grows where it's planted, roots wide underneath. No matter how many storms pass it, the apple never falls far from the tree. The tree reaches out with its branches. Springtime comes, blossoming. Early autumn, the leaves are dancing. And in the winter, there's wood for heat. I've tried leaving and being something I was never meant. I've tried staying, ever changing, and standing in one place just like that tree. The tree keeps
coming up, writer Michael Arsenault talks about growing up in Houston, Black, Catholic, and gay. His new memoir is called I Can't Date Jesus, Love, Sex, Family, Race, and Other Reasons That Put My Faith in Beyonce. This is Fresh Air Weekend. My guest, Michael Arsenault, has written a new book whose title will give you an idea of his sense of humor. It's called I Can't Date Jesus, Love, Sex, Family, Race, and Other Reasons I've Put My Faith in Beyonce. It's a collection of personal essays about his early years growing up in Houston, Black, Catholic, and gay. Arsenault abandoned the Catholic Church about 16 years ago in what he describes as an act of self-preservation, after deciding he was no longer willing to be part of an institution that condemned him for who he was. Over time, he says, he's tried to unlearn every damaging thing he's seen and heard about his identity. He writes for The Root and Essence and has an advice column on Into, which describes itself as a digital magazine for the modern queer world. Michael Arsenault, welcome to Fresh Air. So you were raised Catholic, and you say the traditions associated with the Black Church were different from the church traditions you grew up with. What were some of the differences?
One thing I would say about the Catholic Church that I actually enjoyed was kind of the pageantry of it. It's a beautiful service, but, you know, it can be boring when most of your friends, well, I'm Black, I'm around Black people, they go to Baptist churches, they have gospel choirs, they have this singing and they have praise dance and they have all this celebration, which I wasn't really familiar with. It's just different dynamics because the Catholic Church, to me, is far more formal than any other kind of Christian sect there is. And yeah, it was boring.
Do you feel like you were left out of what is often considered to be a key part of the Black experience in America?
I actually don't. I understand why a lot of people who kind of maybe miss certain parts maybe have that, they feel like they don't get all of Blackness, but I've never struggled with being Black. I come from a very black family, a very Southern Black family. I just think that strain that my family's from, like French Creole, like the Louisiana type stuff, like a lot of them were traditionally raised Catholic. I think that was the only difference that I really had from most people. But, you know, my dad is very Black. My mom is very Black. I grew up working class, to say the least. My high schools were predominantly Black, very sometimes school-to-prison pipeline type Black. So I didn't feel foreign to Blackness. I just think that was just one aspect that I couldn't really relate to. And it was fun. That actually didn't bother me as much. I think some people, the only thing I had to sometimes convince people that I don't worship the Virgin Mary or something like some stereotype associated with Catholics. But other than that, it was fine. I've never questioned my Blackness.
So you write that, you know, you struggle with what it is that you do believe in, but you know you're not an atheist. Why, if you've given up basically on your religion, what's the difference between that and being an atheist?
If I ever reached what I think my lowest point with religion, at least struggling with organized religion, it was probably maybe an embracement of being agnostic. But I do believe there is something, and I personally call it God. And one thing I wanted to do with the book was kind of allow sometimes grayness and to not like have a definitive answer because, frankly, I still don't know. You know, I write about the first time I had been to church and all that, and all those years, well over a decade. And I like the idea of Christianity, but I don't frankly believe in it. So that's a very good question, Terry Gross. I'm clearly still wrestling with it. But I wouldn't call myself an atheist because I do believe in something. I still actively pray. I believe in a God, and I just don't think I believe in maybe necessarily the Christian God I was raised to believe in. But I do like the idea of actual Christians who actually practice the teachings of Christ. I think Jesus is like a swell guy. I would love to be his friends with him, but the rest I'm a little bit distant from. But yes, you're going to have me. I don't want to call myself an atheist, though. My mom would hit me with a Bible. But I believe in something. I'm still wrestling with it, Terry Gross.
So when you realized you were gay, which was like really early on, even though you didn't have the language for it, did you know early on, like, okay, that means you'd be considered an outcast in the Catholic Church? Like, how old were you when you realized that your sexual orientation would not be accepted in your church?
Oh, I picked it up very early from my mom. Again, I love my mom so much, but I remember the Catholic Leave, I believe, those newsletters that would come to our house. So I would see the language about gay people then, and they were more blunt. I think it was just like homosexual. It was very communicated very early, like being gay is wrong. I knew very quickly when I write about the issue with my uncle dying of AIDS, but on the religious front, it was just very clear through the literature my mom had around the house, the things that she watched, or even just casual comments made by the people around me. It was very clear that all around, be it my community, non-religious community, religious community, people felt a way about you being gay, particularly at that time.
Your first exposure to what it meant to be a gay man was when your uncle died of AIDS. You were still very young, and your father told you he died of AIDS because he was gay. Your mother told you he died of AIDS because he shot heroin. Who did you believe?
So my dad didn't necessarily directly tell me. He just yelled a slur. And it's interesting. Thankfully, while I was writing it, I had a very honest conversation with my sister. I later learned that that was particularly just my dad's way of communicating his hurt and that my dad actually probably didn't have as big an issue maybe as I thought. But at the time, all I heard was a lot of gay bashing. So in the heat of the moment, his anger, however he chose to handle it, I believed him. I just believed him because he was so angry. And one thing that I will say about my parents, particularly my father, is I found so much about them largely through their fights. When my dad is his angriest and when he would drink, that is when the truth would come out about a lot of things. And not to say that my mom is a liar. She's usually very direct and blunt, but she was always more protective. So it was like it wasn't that difficult a decision to figure out like, who's telling the truth. I'm like, when he's mad, he's going off. That's what he does. And so I believed him. And that's when my paranoia about AIDS started and being gay.
Yeah. Oh, one more thing about your mother. When she told you that your uncle actually died because he shot heroin, do you think she already knew that you were gay and wanted to protect you from the fear of AIDS? Or do you think that she thought, like, being gay was a worse sin than shooting heroin, and she wanted to protect you from the fact that your uncle was gay?
What's interesting about my mom, I don't think she did the false equivalence, but I do think her belief in her religion steers so much of her thought process on things like this, so I think she let that drive her. As far as my mom knowing, I knew as a child. My mom clocked me. I remember one time we were driving home from school, and out of nowhere, my mom just, in her gray Impala, was like, yeah, Michael, I know some people probably make fun of the way you walk and talk. And then I'm in the back of the car like, girl, no, they don't. At least, I mean, maybe a few people, but it's not like a thing, not like you seem to think. So, but, you know, as I got older, I'm like, oh, she probably saw very early, like, oh, here we go. I got a gay child. Like, she's been around a lot of gay people in spite of all this. So, like, I'm sure she clocked me very early, but we never talked about it. It wasn't until I brought it to her attention that she addressed it directly. But there were little hints along the way that she picked up what I was putting down.
But the thing is, she picked up really early that you were probably gay. But when you actually came out to her, and you did this after writing an article that you were pretty sure she would see, she didn't accept it. So how do you kind of reconcile that she knew and was able to articulate it, although she withheld it from you? She knew really early on that you were gay, that was just your nature. At the same time, she couldn't accept it.
That initial revelation and her reaction was very painful to me. As to why she didn't bring it up sooner, I think my mom comes from, it's a very kind of older, very older black, particularly Southern kind of way where you don't really dive into the personal like that. You keep your business to yourself. You particularly keep your business if you think it's something like being gay, which she thinks is an affliction of God or whatever. So I don't think she wanted to tackle it directly because it wasn't something that she wanted to address, and I don't think it's something that she wanted to address, particularly because if I run my mouth about it, then that might be a reflection of her, and maybe that makes her feel away. I do know she loves me. I do know she doesn't approve. And to be honest, I'm not sure how this book will go over.
But I've been wondering that, too.
Yes, so...
How your parents will deal with your book.
My dad is not going to read it. I know that. He's not going to read it. He might hear something, and at best, he'll go through my sister to maybe communicate a concern. For me and my dad now, we've kind of reached a peace accord as much as humanly possible. I've learned to forgive him for things. I reach out to him when I can. On that front, I've done the best that I can do. My mother is a bit trickier. I actually didn't tell her the title of the book until I turned in the first draft. And she didn't react that well. I just immediately, I'm not making fun of Jesus. And she's like, okay. And she said, well, you know how I feel. And I couldn't do it. And then there was something early in the year where I was really excited about something like that's related to the book, like another dream that I have a part of this. And her response was, well, if that's how you want to live your life, and after that, I just decided that I'm not talking to her about this anymore. And it's not like I'm afraid of her. I've been wanting to have a conversation with her for years. I've wanted to have like a theological conversation. I wanted to like maybe have people come in and maybe talk to us. Like I've really tried to make some real efforts in trying to find some kind of resolution, but I don't think one is available. And I think with her, I'm worried how she will react. But I knew I needed to write this, and I knew I needed to do this. Because one thing I wanted to do was kind of like break the cycle of silence that both my parents have perpetuated. And it's not something I wanted to continue because it brought us all so much pain. So why would I continue to be silent? Why would I allow you to let me feel like something is wrong with me?
So you mentioned your mother really hates the title of your book. The title of your book is I Can't Date Jesus. Why did you give it that title? What does that title mean to you?
Well, the title's about her. So that's the thing. Like, I, despite my own kind of misgivings or concern, like doubts about religion, I really do respect the role that faith plays in people. I think that's one reason why so many Christians still like me. I really, like, for my mom is the strongest person I know. Her faith is what has kept her alive. And I respect that and I admire that. But what she doesn't seem to understand is that the faith that she was raised in may keep her alive, but it makes me want to die. Or at the very least, not lead a full life. And what point is living if you can't lead a complete full life? And so the chapter is named after an exchange that we had. So I had already told her previously that I was gay, and then we left it alone, and then it came up again. And we had this conversation where she says, I know that you're born gay. I know that you can't help it. But if you have sex and get hit by a bus, I don't know where you're going to go. My mom can be morbid, bless her heart. And in my mind, when that was going on, I was like, well, girl, I can't date Jesus. And so that is what the title happened. Like, I think the thing about religion sometimes to me that does bother me is that I find my mom to be such a smart person, such a very thoughtful person. Like, I wouldn't be as analytical as I tend to be and critical if not for her. But I think in order for her and for her faith to keep her going, she has to kind of suppress maybe her better urges. I mean, like, it's like, you know that I'm gay. You know that I can't help it, but you don't want me to act on my natural urges on the basis of a maybe that if, I don't know, a bus hits me or some, I don't know, a bike might take me out of New York, that I might die and maybe go to hell, which is just, I mean, I'm sure that makes all the sense in the world to her and quite a few people, but it just sounds so ridiculous to me. So I'm like, so I should just let all of that area down there just turn into, like, I don't know, the code, whatever, and not have a full life. Like, why would I do that? Like, what sense does that make to me? And so, yeah, I can't date Jesus. I would love to kick it with him maybe at a bar, but other than that, we're good.
Beyonce means a lot to you, and, you know, kind of always has since the Destiny's Child era. So, you know, at the risk of stating the obvious, what does she mean to you, and what did she mean to you when you were young and trying to figure out who you were and to understand your own sexuality?
Oh, Terry, I'm about to testify. Beyonce is, as I write in the book, my Lord and gyrator, the end, the beginning, the body roll. She's everything to me. Initially, what I just loved about Beyonce, it was that, and Destiny's Child, but specifically Beyonce, like, it was, for me, it was like Love at First Southside, and that's a dance that they were doing at the beginning of the No, No, No video. They were from Houston, Texas, and they looked like people that I knew. I had just missed Beyonce. We went to the same middle school, but she was like one grade out, and then they got that label deal. So, you know, that was my chance to be her bestie, and it didn't happen. But one thing I initially just loved about them is that they were from Houston, so we didn't have groups like that blow up from Houston, Texas. And then now I'm going to make sure I don't sound like Yolanda Saldivar, but there's just always been something about Beyonce that I've been drawn to. I love the way she talks. And also I love the fact that, you know, she and her family's from Louisiana, moved to Houston. So in that we have that shared thing. Just the way she sounds makes me happy. Like, but specifically with my sexuality and me being most comfortable with myself, there was this album, the B-Day album. And one thing about Beyonce now is that in the recent years, everyone talks about how pro-black she is and what that means. And I think that's more so because it was, I guess, outwardly intellectual. But what pro-black often means to me, too, is that this is a Southern black girl who is very country, like country as hell, and she owns every bit of that. She is very much from Houston, Texas. Like, even if you don't necessarily get the references, as someone from Houston, I do. So to me, she's always been subversively sneaking a lot of subcultures into the mainstream. Like for B-Day, for example, those are queer black men who are choreographing the stuff. There's like slang in there. Like there's a New Orleans bounce record that she made into an R&B song. One thing that I've always wanted to do, and even actually in the journey and trying to get this book sold, was that there was this idea that because I was both black and gay, that I was niche, that I was very limited, that I didn't have as much appeal as someone else, and that I often would have to dilute myself to be able to reach the masses. When the biggest pop star in the world is a country black girl named Beyonce from Houston, Texas, who outside of maybe the first half of the I Am Sasha Fierce album, where she did that kind of like Sarah McLachlan thing, which is fine, just not my, you know, I want to bop to Beyonce usually, but she's pulled the masses to her being exactly who she is this entire time. And for me, that has just been so inspirational. And again, with the B-Day album, you know, this is around the time that I came out and when I was starting to go to clubs. I felt a little out of place because people were clearly more advanced than me, more comfortable with their bodies. But that album was a very big hit in the gay black clubs. And I remember actually going to the bar and I was like, just have another drink and chill out and have fun. Stop worrying so much about how you dance, how you look, how you talk, your mannerisms. Just enjoy the moment. And through that album and just dancing to it, I just felt freer for so many reasons, but I feel that connection to her. Like she makes me feel really good about myself. And I know that might sound whatever to certain people, but you know, there's always someone in your life that is influencing you. And even if I don't know her, she's been very impactful in my life. She let me know that I could be myself, and she let me know that being myself could reach as many people as possible, that you don't have to dilute, again, who you are to reach everyone, that you can just be yourself and be very good at what you do, and then the people will come to you. And that's a lesson I'm going to carry with me for the rest of my life.
Well, Michael Arsenault, I wish you good luck with your writing, and thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you so much for having me. It has been such an honor and a pleasure.
Michael Arsenault is the author of the new collection of personal essays, I Can't Date Jesus, Love, Sex, Family, Race, and Other Reasons I've Put My Faith in Beyoncé.